We are coming in our study in Galatians chapter 6 to the end of the first paragraph, which I have taken to be verses 1 to 5. I think some of the texts have the division a little bit larger than that, but I felt like verses 1 to 5 were our unit. And a couple of weeks ago, the last time we were together, we were actually raising the issue of verse 4 as to whether Paul was serious about what he was telling them to do. And I argued that I didn't think that he was actually telling us to examine our own works so that we would have a basis for boasting in our works, since he's the one who says in verse 14 of this chapter that he didn't boast in anything except the cross of Christ. And therefore, the idea that he would encourage us to find a basis for boasting somewhere else just doesn't ring a bell with me. It doesn't sound true. And verse 4 also seems to be a continuation of the issue that was raised in verses 1, 3, and 4, where he's addressing an attitude problem in a group of people who might be inclined to try to correct other people's problems. Because that's what the issue is. If a man, verse 1, is caught in a trespass, you who are spiritual are supposed to try to restore him. So that means you try to fix his problem. Well, there are all kinds of people in this world who are always trying to fix other people's problems. And Paul knew that one of the big blocks of people who are heavily into trying to correct other people's problems are what we just typically call legalists. They're people who think that it's their job to make other people behave a certain way and to rebuke them if they're not and that kind of thing. And always lurking in the background of that is an attitude about themselves. And Paul said in verse 1, you need to be really careful. You who are spiritual need to be really careful when you're going to try to help a brother who has gotten caught, lest you be tempted yourself to fall into a similar or worse situation. And then there's a little digression, verse 2, where he tells the spiritual ones how to help by bearing one another's burdens. And then in verse 3, he goes back to the issue of verse 2, or verse 1, the second part, where he's talking about being real careful about how you think about yourself in relation to this issue and exercising the spirit of gentleness, because there's a strong temptation for anybody who isn't having a struggle with an issue to look down their nose at somebody who is and think that they are superior in some way to that individual, and that means that they think they're something when they're nothing. And you got to really be careful, because that's self-delusional. It actually makes you crazy. But then in verse 4, he just comes on with this thing about, if you're going to try to find a foundation for feeling good about yourself, at least restrict yourself to your own works. Don't use somebody else's lack of or poor performance as a basis for you deciding that you're doing a good job. In other words, don't use somebody else's works as the backdrop for your comparison of your works to that in order to make yourself feel good about yourself. Because that's really what he's driving at, finding a basis for boasting. And he says, absolutely, you cannot find your basis for boasting in looking at somebody else's poor performance and making yourself look better by looking at it that way. The only valid, if there is a valid basis, is examining your own works against a valid criteria background and then deciding that you can have this exultant joy based on your performance. My argument last time was that you can't do that. Paul said in his letter to the Corinthians that he didn't care who judged him. It didn't matter to him what their attitude about him was. And he said, I don't even judge myself because I don't know of anything against myself, but I'm not by that justified, so we'll have to wait till God brings everything to light. Well, if you have to wait till God brings everything to light, how in the world can you examine yourself, your own works, and throw them up against God's standard, since you don't know everything that's involved in that? So it was my argument that verse 4 is simply Paul pushing the envelope on telling people who have a penchant for trying to correct other people's behavior to be really careful that they're not using other people's failures as a basis for their own feel-good feelings about themselves. I really think that in the larger context, the only real basis we have for exultant joy is the love that God has for us demonstrated in the death of His Son. That is our basis for joy. It's our basis for exulting joy, because it means something profoundly good, and none of this other stuff does. So, in verse 5, he just winds this paragraph up with this little comment, "For each one shall bear his own load." And what does that mean? I mean, he's already said in verse 4, "Let each one examine his own work, and then he'll have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one shall bear his own load." And then the King James uses the word burden in verse 2 and 5. And the New American Standard actually makes an effort to alert you to the fact that the word burden in verse 2 and the word load in verse 5 are not the same, and that's true. They're not. And there's a reason. So that's part of what we're going to be doing this evening. What did Paul say, and what did he mean in verse 5 about everybody bearing their own load? What does that mean? What are the implications of it? How are we supposed to respond to that? I really think that verse 5 of chapter 6 puts a huge damper on the notion that exultant joy will come out of accomplishment, because verse 5 is kind of a downer. You're going to bear your own load. And it also almost contradicts verse 2, where you're supposed to bear one another's burdens, but you're going to end up carrying your own load. And the word bear is the same in both verses. So you're going to bear your own load, you're going to bear your own burden, or whatever. So that's where we're headed. We're going to try to look at the issues in verse 5 about what load are we going to bear. What is the issue of our load? And in order to do that, I just want to remind you of some things that I've already reminded you of, sort of, but I want to do it a little bit more progression. Paul's introductory words in this paragraph set the stage. He's addressing the problem of a moral failure by a fellow believer, if anybody is caught in a trespass. He's talking about the moral failures of any man, assuming that that's a believer. And he is giving some instruction on how we're supposed to relate to that. He says, those of you who are spiritual have a responsibility here. The issue of the responsibility is established by the word restore. His goal is restoration. The idea of being caught in a trespass means that you've gone off the deep end somewhere, or you've fallen off the track or something, and the idea is to get you back to where you were before you succumbed to the temptation. That's the idea of being restored. You're brought back to where you were before you succumbed. And that's Paul's goal in all of this instruction. But the issues of the goal are two. To accomplish that goal, there are two things that have to be taken into account. The one of them is introduced in verse 1 with the phrase, "you who are spiritual." That addresses an attitude issue. The attitude of the spiritual in pursuit of the goal of restoration. He says you're supposed to use meekness as an attitude toward God. In other words, you who are spiritual, in a spirit of gentleness. That's the word that was used in chapter 5, verse 22. And we said in that study that that word Trench identifies as an attitude about the firm conviction that God is present in this circumstance and willing to work in this setting. An attitude that most of us don't take seriously. Some things develop and we wonder, where is God? Well, He's right here. Well, what's He going to do? Well, whatever needs to be done right here, given what needs to be done. And that partly may be an attitude issue on our own part that needs to be addressed. But nonetheless, if we're going to accomplish the goal of restoration, the spiritual have to have an attitude of meekness. That's a strong conviction that God is present and He is willing to work in the current situation. That's His commitment, and that's what meekness expects. So that in the fruit of the Spirit, Faith is what we render toward God, confidence in Him, and that fundamentally means when the going gets rough. Meekness is, He's here. I trust Him. He's here. He's ready to do something. And then there's the approach. There's an attitude and an approach. And in the approach, verse 2 says, take on some of the burden. Get under that with them. In other words, do what you have to do to try to alleviate the problem for this person who's been overtaken. So there's an attitude of meekness and there's a willingness to get under the burden, and that's an actual action. That's an approach. However, from that point on, verse 3 and 4, and if I understand verse 5 properly, it's all now about attitude. The action of bearing, getting under the thing, he kind of just lets that go. He assumes that maybe we'll figure out what needs to be done here. But he doesn't assume that his readers are going to have the right attitude. He assumes that there's a great big possibility that they won't. And that's why he says in verse 3, there's his attitude. That if you think you're something when you're nothing, sorry attitude, you're nuts. Verse 4, if you're looking for a basis for exultant joy, at the very minimum, if you're going to use your works as a basis for doing that, at the very minimum, do not compare those works to anything your brother might be doing or not. He is not your basis for exultant joy. I would argue that not even your own works are, but then that's my understanding of verse 4. The reason for that is there is a potent tendency for people who observe the moral failures of others, there's a potent tendency to be seriously blind in regarding to their own moral failures. That's verse 3. I've actually witnessed this because I can see it in others. You probably could come up with illustrations that you've seen in me. But I'm blind in those areas. I'm not blind when I'm looking this way. I have actually sat and listened to a person gossiping heavily about a person that they name, so it's not one of these kind of things where you're keeping the identity secret. And the big gossiping thing was how that person was a gossip. And it was just pow, right in your face. You know, are you gossiping about a gossip because they shouldn't be gossiping? You know, that kind of thing. Well, we see this when other people do it. We just don't see it when we do. So there is this potent tendency to have a blindness to our own participation in the very thing that we find so offensive in other people. In fact, sometimes the psychologists even say that we're most offended by the things we're most guilty of when other people are doing them. We don't get nearly as offended when we're the ones that are guilty. We're just a little humiliated if somebody brings it to light, and they're lucky if we don't get angry with them. But that's a potent tendency that Paul recognized, and that's why verse 3 is in there. But there's also a potent tendency for those who are concerned about the moral failures of others to go immediately into a works kind of mentality, where the works theology argues that if they would just do the right thing, they would have the right outcome. That's works theology. And this comes across a lot of times when people's troubles, where their moral failures have caught them badly, and they're really in a mess, and the person sits back and says, well, they brought it on themselves. Well, duh. Yeah. But who doesn't do that? And that's why the attitude of the spiritual is not, well, you wouldn't catch me dead doing that, because yes, we would. We wouldn't catch you dead doing it. We'd just catch you doing it. That's where the attitude of the spiritual is with meekness, where, yeah, they got caught, and yes, it's a disaster for them, and no, I'm not guilty right now of that, but that's not the point. The point is we need God to do something here. So in a spirit of meekness, we pull God into the mix and try to restore the person without making us the superior person in the mix. So there's this potent tendency to immediately go to a works kind of philosophy in dealing with other people's problems. And the outcome of that is what? Well, we're going to start giving them advice on how to behave better. Well, if you just do this, you know, overtaken by the fault of covetousness, for example. Covetousness often shows up with people spending more than they've got coming in. And then they get themselves into heavy-duty financial disaster. And what's our counsel? Well, here, let me show you how to handle your money better. Well, that isn't going to work. It's not that they didn't know how to handle their money better. It's that they wanted something and they spent it. They wanted it so bad that it didn't matter the consequences. They wanted it, and so they got it, and now they're caught. The only person who can straighten that out is God. He's the only one who can curb our appetites for stuff so that we don't spend our money foolishly. He's the only one that can do that. That's a heart change issue that he's responsible or capable. Let me say it that way. He's the one who's capable of doing it. And if we pull him into the mix, perhaps he'll have mercy on this person and do whatever needs to be done so that they don't get in that bind again. Otherwise, you're going to be into this works thing where the solution to a sorry life is better performance. And then, thirdly, there's also another potent tendency. So we've got potent tendencies everywhere, okay? We got this potent tendency to be seriously blind to our own participation in the very thing we're criticizing somebody else. We have this potent tendency to go immediately to a works mentality where you can correct this problem by doing certain kinds of things. And then there's, thirdly, a potent tendency to actually dismiss the end reality of our own participation in the very works theology that we're trying to push on somebody else. That's verse 5. You're going to bear your own burden. You're going to carry your own load, he says. Each one. What he's saying is, you need to be really careful here, because what you're talking about is actually loading somebody else up because you're trying to correct them by your works mentality. And you need to be aware of that. Because you're doing that to them, you're setting yourself up for disaster. And when it comes, you'll be the one who has to bear it. So, I really believe that what's going on here is, within this thought flow of these five verses, verse 5 is the final nail in the coffin to how to mishandle, or how not to mishandle, a brother's spiritual failing. If you really want to help him, don't do it this way. And that's kind of verses 3 through 5. So, that brings us to the details of verse 5. The word that's translated load. I've already mentioned that King James translators mislead us here because they translate both words burdens and they're not the same word. It may be that they have some overlap in terms of field of meaning. They may be what we call synonyms in a sense. But the fact is, the word that's translated load by the New American Standard translators in verse 5 is a word that's only used in 6 contexts in the New Testament, 3 of which are simply repeats of 3. So there's only really 3 original contexts, and then there's 3 that repeat those. So out of the whole New Testament, you find this load thing in 3 distinct places or unique places. And with one exception, in the 6 of the 3 that are repeated, all of them are negative but 1. And that's not heavy. I mean, that's 5 out of 6, okay? Percentage-wise, it sounds impressive, but when it's only 5 out of 6, when there's only 6 to start with. But the fact is that in three of these cases, the issue is legal necessities that are rooted in legal consequences. In other words, you need to do this because this is what's going to happen because the law says, you do this, this is what's going to happen. So if you don't want this to happen, then you got to do something else. That's a legal base. And when the concept of a load is tied to a legal basis, we already know that the issue is the outworking of verse 4, where you're doing your own works and you're creating your own load because you're making choices and you're taking action with an overtone of implication that the choices you're making and the actions you're taking are not any better than the person's whose failure has brought it to everybody's attention and needs some help. In other words, you're making the same mistake he made. Only yours hasn't blown up in your face yet, but I'm telling you, it's going to. And when it does, you're going to bear it yourself. That's the overtone of that word. It's negative. You know, the load that you're going to bear is not a happy thing. The only place that's not a happy thing, and even then it's not really a happy thing, is Jesus in Matthew 11. He says, if you're laboring and heavy loaded, laden, come to me. And you'll find rest to your soul because my yoke is easy and my load is light. So even in Jesus' statement, he acknowledges a yoke and a load, but he says, in effect, the yoke's easy, the load's light. So if you need rest for your soul, I can give you a better end result than all this labor that you're laboring and you're heavy laden over. Come to me, learn from me, you'll have rest because my load's light. Well, what kind of light load is Jesus providing? That's the issue. And I really believe that bearing your own load is a way of saying that you're simply going to have to live with the consequences of your choices and actions without anybody else's help. In verse 2, the spiritual are urged to get under the load of another, or a burden of another person. And the implication there is, if you're heavily burdened, then somebody can step under that burden with you and help you out. But in verse 5, Paul is in effect saying, no, if you create this load, you're going to live with it. Nobody's going to help you out. So it means you live with the consequences. You live with the consequences. You took this load on because of an attitude that you had toward somebody else who had a burden that had caused them to be defeated. And instead of stepping under that and helping them out, you came on like, I'm the answer man here, and you just listen to me, and I'll tell you what to do, and it'll all work out because you're doing the right things, and on and on and on. Paul says you're building a load, and when it comes down on you, you're going to have to bear it. You're going to have to carry it. So the real question here is, what is Paul talking about in terms of the load? Is he talking about a generic truth of everybody is going to have to carry their own load, or is he still addressing the legal-minded ones of verses 3 and 4? That's the question. There is a sense in which the Scriptures teach a generic truth that applies to all men in respect to what we would simply call Day of Reckoning. We all know that there's the Great White Throne Judgment, and we've all heard about the Judgment Seat of Christ. And we all know the distinction, the Great White Throne of Judgment is for people who've never been born again, and the Judgment Seat of Christ is for every person who's been born in the family. And the general tenor of understanding of the judgments is that there are some consequences that fall upon you because of the way the judgments come out. And under the Great White Throne, the outcome is someplace in hell. I mean, it'll be worse for some than others because Jesus said that. He said it's worse for some people than others in the Day of Judgment. Well, I mean, hell's going to have different temperatures and different problems. The fact is, though, the outcome of the Great White Throne Judgment is going to be bad. What about the outcome of the Judgment Seat of Christ? In what sense is it going to be bad? In what sense is it a load? Is there a sense in which it's a load in the sense of verse 5? My argument is that the load that is applicable to believers is the load that Jesus said was light, that you could get this lightened situation if you would come to me. If you're laboring and you're heavily burdened, loaded, if you'll come to me, I'll put a light yoke and an easy yoke and a light load on you, and you'll have rest. That makes me think that verse 5 doesn't apply to that kind of scenario, because Jesus is actually offering a very positive thing. Verse 5 is not a real positive thing. He's just telling you, hey, you're going to carry it. Whatever you create, you're going to carry it. That doesn't sound real positive to me. So I would argue that the load that Paul's talking about in verse 5 is only ultimately applicable to people who did not come to Jesus so that they wouldn't have to live with a heavy load. Because he said they'd have a light one if they would come. So if you don't want a light, if you have a heavy load, it's because you didn't come. And quite frankly, even in 2 Corinthians 5, where Paul says we must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ to give an answer for the deeds done in the body, whether good or bad, he says in verse 11, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men. And seriously, back when I was more of a legalist than I am now, I always took that to mean that Paul was acknowledging that there is this terrible terror that brought on by the judgment seat of Christ, and knowing the terror that's going to be, that you're going to be held accountable under the judgment seat of Christ, you better do your job. Paul's job was persuading men. So knowing the terror of the Lord, I'm terrified of terror, of being terrorized by the Lord, so I do what I'm told. That's what I used to think. I don't think that way anymore. I really believe that what Paul's saying in 2 Corinthians 5:11 is knowing the terror of the Lord, knowing what God's wrath is going to mean for people. We're doing our best to get them out from under that. We're trying to persuade them so that they can get out from under this heavy load that's going to come because of the wrath of God. So instead of being terrorized by the concept of the judgment seat of Christ upon me for failing, the issue is being aware of the terror that God's justice means for people, and therefore being willing to commit myself to trying to help them get away out from under that load by persuading them of the truth. In Paul's case, preaching the gospel. In our case, maybe it's the same thing. Getting people to trust God so that they're not creating this huge load at the great white throne. That boils down then, in my thinking, to this, that verse 5 technically does not apply to anybody except the legalist. A legalist is a person in the book of Galatians who thinks that the solution to the problems of life is obedience to God. Render obedience. Behave yourself. Do what you're told. Life will be a lot better if you do that. Well, granted, life's a lot better for obedient people. There's no question about that. The question is whether you can tie life to obedience. That's the question. The only reason obedience leads to joy, the joy of life, and life's better because you're obedient, is simply because the joy flows from God to you through an unhindered relationship. That's the point of obedience. It's not that your work gets you more joy. It's that your obedience keeps the barriers from raising up to keep the joy flowing, or from flowing, from him to you. Sure, life's better if you obey. And yeah, there are consequences if you don't. But what's the real root? That's belief. It's that you obey what you believe and you disobey what you don't believe. And so Paul would just argue that that's the issue. The bottom line, the hope of righteousness is through the Spirit by faith, according to chapter 5, verse 5. And hope is what is the attitude of the person who is trusting in the promise of God. And the person who is trusting in the promise of God has an attitude of mind and heart that affects the choices he makes and the actions he takes. And therefore, the joy of life is tied to whether you trust or not. Not whether your behavior will fit a certain criteria. So, verse 5 consists then of the final warning to a person whose approach to the failures of others with a critical spirit, with an attitude that if they'll just listen to me, I can help them because I wouldn't be caught dead in that problem, and I can help them if they'll just let me do that. I know how to live better than they know how to live. I'm a teacher, I'm an instructor of the babes, and, you know. This verse is the final statement for that kind of person. You may not realize it or not, Paul says, but you're creating a load. All of this works theology is going to come down on your head one of these days. And when it does, there ain't going to be anybody to help you. You're going to bear it yourself. You're going to carry your own. And the reason that you're going to carry your own is because in the bottom, the final analysis, legal theology requires it. When your brother was, or this man that you saw that was a failure, and you decided that you would correct his failure and help him out, because you would not get under the burden with him, you just told him what else to do. You made, like the lawyers, made all these rules, but you didn't lift a finger to help. Because you didn't get under the burden to help him, you had an attitude of superiority and all that stuff. That's not helping. You didn't get under the burden to help him. So when it comes time for you to carry your load, guess what? There ain't going to be anybody get under that one with you. That's what the law says. You reap what you sow. That, in that sense, the law says, if you won't help, you're not going to get help. That's the final application of the law to a legalist. You're creating a huge load for yourself. And when it comes down to it, your legal theology will keep anybody from being able to help you in that day. You're going to carry it yourself. That's how I understand verse 5.